Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. And welcome to this issue of Reminiscing. I'll be reading the stories from the December issue of the Good Old Days magazine. And, of course, most of the stories are about Christmas. Here's a leftover Thanksgiving item. This is from the Bits and Pieces section. It's entitled Thanksgiving in Albuquerque. This was sent in by Betty Steinar Swisher. The year was 1953. My husband, Chuck, was in the U.S. Army stationed at Sandia Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Along with other young couples, we had living quarters off the base called row houses. Each row house consisted of one large room that served as the kitchen and living room. There was also a small bedroom with a connecting bathroom. The floors were linoleum. Sand and dust blew in the houses through the unsealed windows and spaces under the doors. That autumn would be the first time Chuck and I were away from our family members at Thanksgiving. But, much to our delight, several other Army couples we met at the row houses wanted to celebrate Thanksgiving with us. One couple from Brooklyn volunteered to furnish the turkey. "I've heard of a new way to roast a turkey," Carolyn eagerly volunteered. "You put the turkey in a brown paper bag and roast it in a slow oven," she continued. "From all I've heard, this paper bag method is the only way to roast a turkey." There were three couples besides Chuck and me who brought food for Thanksgiving dinner. When it was time to take the turkey out of the oven, all of us hovered around Carolyn to see what the turkey would look like. Most of us had doubts and believed the traditional way to roast a turkey was the best and only way. The large turkey had barely fit in the small oven. The allotted time Carolyn projected for roasting the turkey must have been the right time. When she pulled the roasting pan and turkey out from the oven, steam flowed from the pan, and the aroma made our senses sharp. The rest of the food was placed on the small dining table. We sat side by side at the table. Strangers at first, we, from different far corners of our United States, gathered together to share this Thanksgiving dinner. It was a brown paper bag turkey feast. I will never forget that Thanksgiving dinner or the people who shared it with us. This was Thanksgiving in Albuquerque by Betty Steinar Swisher. And here's a little Christmas treat, entitled Christmas 1956. This was sent in by Sarah Etkin Baker. Christmas 1956, Santa delivered some special presents to our home. He delivered our family's first black and white television, and I received not one, but two dolls, while my brother received the boys' toy of the time, a gun and holster set. That Christmas evening, my brother decided the doll, shown in my left hand in the picture, needed a bath. It was made of sawdust, so when he put it in the bathtub, it soaked up water like a sponge, eventually disintegrating. I remember being inconsolable. That was Christmas 1956 by Sarah Etkin Baker. Now here's an item from the Looking Hollywood Way section of the magazine, and it's entitled Christmas with Andy Williams. All of his shows had one common theme. It was all about family. This was written by Michael O'Donnell. Each December from 1962 to 1972, watching a holiday special on TV that featured singer Andy Williams and his family was a great way to get into the Christmas spirit. You always knew you would hear standards like Sleigh Ride, White Christmas, and I'll Be Home for Christmas, and beloved sacred carols like O Holy Night and Ave Maria. During those years, Andy also released three best-selling Christmas albums. He was known to many as Mr. Christmas because of his devotion to celebrating the most wonderful time of the year. Born in 1927 in Wall Lake, Iowa, Andy was welcomed by three older brothers, Bob, Don, and Dick. Under their father's tutelage, the four began singing in church when they were very young, learning to sing in perfect harmony. In 1938, when Andy was 11, the four siblings formed a quartet known as the Williams Brothers. They did so well that they had a radio show in the Midwest. In 1943, the family moved to California. And in 1944, the brothers sang backup for Bing Crosby on Swingin' on a Star, Bing's hit song from the movie Going My Way. And they appeared uncredited in several movie musicals. After serving during World War II, the Williams brothers reunited and became backup singers and dancers for radio star Kay Thompson, better known now for her role in Funny Face with Audrey Hepburn in 1957, and as the writer of the 1950s children's book series Eloise. And they had great success in Las Vegas. In 1949, the act broke up, but they reunited for a tour from 1951 to 1953. After that, the Williams brothers went their separate ways professionally, as the older brothers were tired of touring and wanted to settle down. Thompson continued to be an influence in Andy's life, writing songs and arrangements for his solo career. Andy was a regular on Tonight, starring Steve Allen, on NBC from 1954 to 1957, singing in 276 episodes of the live late-night show. During that same time, in 1954, Andy signed a contract with Cadence Records and had several top 10 hits, including Are You Sincere? In 1958, The Village of St. Bernadette in 1959, and Lonely Street, also 1959. In 1962, he was asked to sing the theme song from the 1961 movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, starring Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard, at the Academy Awards. With over 18 million viewers watching, Andy performed Moon River, composed by Henry Mancini with lyrics by Johnny Mercer, which won Best Original Song that evening. Now signed with Columbia Records, Andy had already recorded the album Moon River and Other Great Movie Themes, which was released the same day the Oscars were televised. The album remained on the charts for 3 years, peaking at number 3. Although he had had a successful show business career for many years, his performance that evening and the subsequent hit song made Andy Williams a bona fide star. The Andy Williams Show premiered on NBC in September 1962. And in December, the first of his many Christmas specials aired. Edward Pola and George Weil wrote, "It's the most wonderful time of the year, especially for Andy." And it became a staple on his Christmas shows throughout the years. Billboard rated Andy's original version of the song number 5 in the top 10 Christmas songs ever recorded. In 1961, Andy married French actress Claudine Longet, and the couple eventually had 3 children, Christian, Noel, and Bobby, all of whom appeared on his Christmas programs as youngsters. Also joining Andy on his Christmas specials were his parents and his brothers and their families. As a grown-up, Andy's son Bobby commented that watching reruns of the shows was like watching the best home movies ever. Another family, the Osmonds, Alan, Wayne, Merrill, and Jay, first made an appearance on The Andy Williams Show. Christmas special in December 1962, when they were just a quartet. Donnie Osmond, 4 years old at the time they were filming that first special, was deemed too young. But the next year he joined the group, and they became just the Osmonds. The brothers appeared more than 20 times on various Andy Williams programs and were a staple on his Christmas specials. Between 1973 and 1982, Andy produced several more Christmas specials on TV, but he stated in an interview that even when he wasn't on television, he continued to do live Christmas specials every year. Out of the 43 studio compilation and live albums that Andy recorded over a span of 56 years, 8 were Christmas albums, with 1963's Andy Williams Christmas album being the first. A year after it was released, it was certified gold for selling over 500,000 copies. Besides the success of his single, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year, from his first album in 1965, his Merry Christmas album produced a hit with Do You Hear What I Hear? Both the Andy Williams Christmas album and Merry Christmas Records were eventually certified platinum for sales over 1 million each. In 1992, Andy had the Moon River Theater built in Branson, Missouri, where he continued his traditional Christmas specials until his last performance in 2011. And this was Christmas with Andy Williams by Michael O'Donnell. This next item is entitled The Good Earth. It was a special Christmas message from far away. This was sent in by John Scanlon. It was Christmas Eve, 1968. I remember it like it was yesterday. I was 9 years old and the eldest of 6 children living a humble existence in Stoutsville, Ohio. Earlier, Mom had stated that we could stay up and watch the events of Apollo 8 on our archaic black and white television. Apollo 8 had launched from the Kennedy Space Center with mission dates of December 21st to the 27th, 1968, carrying astronauts Frank Borman II, James Lovell Jr., and William Anders. It would be the first crewed spacecraft to leave low Earth orbit and the first human spaceflight to reach the moon. However, Apollo 8 was not intended to land on the moon. Instead, its mission was to orbit the moon 10 times and then safely return to Earth. Other accomplishments included the first crewed mission, that's C-R-E-W-E-D, mission, launched on a Saturn V SA-503 rocket. The first crew to ascend from Launch Complex 39, which was NASA's new moon port. The first humans to travel into deep space. The first to take pictures of the moon up close and of the Earth that showed its entire shape. Lastly, the three astronauts would witness something no other human had ever seen, the Earth rising over the lunar surface. The photograph that was taken, which was afterward titled Earthrise, became famous all over the world. But the highlight of the mission was yet to come. As I adjusted the rabbit ear antennas on our television, I heard William Anders speaking as the spaceship orbited the moon. For all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. Then Anders read verses 1 to 4 of the Genesis creation narrative from the King James Bible. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. That was followed by Jim Lovell reading verses 5 to 8. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. Lastly, Frank Borman read verses 9 and 10. And God said, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered unto one place, and let the dry land appear," and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Borman concluded the message saying, "And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth." And this was The Good Earth by John Scanlon. This next Christmas story is entitled Two Generations with Sweet Sue. A special gift from Santa made caring for her mom's doll a loving memory. This was sent in by Jennifer Broadstreet Hess. Perfectly painted red ruby lips, flowing auburn tresses, and friendly hazel eyes greeted me that festive Christmas morning in 1977 as I stepped into my grandparents' family room. Sweet Sue, a delicate vintage bride doll, sat patiently with her graceful arms crossed on the comfy plaid sofa. A crimson-red satin bow was tied perfectly in her hair. Brightly wrapped presents were under the tree. These I expected to see, but the presence of the vintage doll took me by surprise. I had told Santa Claus that I wanted for Christmas months before in a carefully written letter. Maybe the fact I was at Grandpa and Grandma Starr's house in Denver instead of my own home in Derby, Kansas on Christmas Eve, had confused Santa. Taking a deep breath, I sauntered over to the couch to view the doll more closely. I wasn't even sure if it was for me. But there was just my brother, Doug, my dad and mom, and my grandparents together in that little room celebrating Christmas morning with one another. A carefully folded note had been placed in the doll's lap. I peered over at my mom and dad as I picked up the note and gingerly opened it. The cursive handwriting was impossible for a 6-year-old girl to read. I handed the note over to my mother. Gazing up at her, my soft, youthful voice broke the silence. "Please, Mommy, can you tell me what Santa Claus wrote?" She smiled, perusing the note's contents with her steady gaze, and began, "Dear Jenny, I once gave this doll to your mom when she was a little girl. I thought you were the right age to care for her as your own. Her name is Sweet Sue. Take good care of her. Love, Santa." I gasped with astonishment at this revelation. Grandma and Grandpa Star, seated side by side on the couch next to Sweet Sue, quietly watched and listened with interest. Grandma leaned over and carefully picked up the delicate bride doll. Grandma's pale blue eyes sparkled with delight behind her spectacles. "This was your mom's doll when she was a very young girl. I still remember that Christmas Day in 1955, like it was yesterday." Her voice faded, and she looked deep in thought as she remembered that precious moment in time. "Golly, this beautiful doll has been in the attic all of these years, since your mother went off to college." Grandpa Star cleared his throat, raising his burly eyebrows with amusement. "Santa must have found it up there in that old attic trunk and decided you should carry on her legacy. Santa Claus didn't want her to be a forgotten relic." Sweet Sue wore a simple ivory satin dress with layers of ruffles that flowed below her ankles. Grandma cradled the doll in her arms as if she were herself a young girl once again, taking a walk down memory lane. Grandma looked at me and said, "I'm guessing you would like to hold Sweet Sue?" Grinning from ear to ear, I leaned in toward her and carefully picked up my new doll. Being made of hard plastic, she felt different from the baby dolls I had in my toy cradle at home. I hugged Sweet Sue tightly, never wanting to let her go. This was such a treasured moment in time. I closed my eyes, rocking her gently. I was trying to imagine what it must have been like for my own mom to receive Sweet Sue for Christmas all those years ago. Mom came and stood beside me, resting her hand on my shoulder. She was beaming with pride. "I'm so happy that Santa found my bride doll and gave her to you. When Santa gave her to me, I was 12 years old. He gave bride dolls to my 3 younger sisters, too. Margaret, Sue, Betty, and I had so much fun taking them for walks and dressing them up on play dates." Mom lightly caressed Sweet Sue's hair with her fingertips. "Goodness, I wish I could remember what happened to her wedding veil. Maybe I can sew a new veil for her when we get home." Years have passed since that wonderful Christmas day in my grandparents' home with my precious family members. Sweet Sue now sits proudly in the china cabinet that was passed down to me by my Grandma Star. I will always cherish Sweet Sue, because she was once my mother's pride and joy. There was a story and history made before the doll was ever gifted to me. And this was Two Generations with Sweet Sue by Jennifer Broadstreet Hess. Now, let's look at some letters that were sent in to the Good Old Days magazine in answer to the editor's question, do you have a creative side? What was your hobby? What was your favorite creation? Here's one answer. Growing up in the 1930s, I had many failed attempts at hobbies. My first hero was Charles Lindbergh, which got me involved in model airplanes, vintage World War I. There were not too many of them. Next came stagecoaches, but they were complicated, had too many pieces, so I could never complete them. I was never what you would call creative, but I was good at following instructions. Watching a steam engine go around became boring. Eureka! My hobby arrived with an Erector set. My crowning achievement was a parachute jump like the one at the New York World's Fair in 1939. This was sent in by Bill Baum of Sonora, California. And this one. One summer, my Aunt Betty taught me how to embroider, and I loved it from the start. Embroidering allowed me to occupy myself when I was feeling a bit stitchy or out of sorts. It also gave me an opportunity to express my creativity, something I valued. I still have many of my girlhood embroidery pieces. When I look at them, I realize that embroidering also taught me some pretty important adult life skills: planning, patience, determination, taking pride in my work, and accepting my uniqueness. For those reasons, embroidering became my lifetime hobby and is something I still enjoy. Sarah Etkin Baker. And that concludes our program. You've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.